seachtain an Indo-Ascaliger.
Táim I mon iarachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam amach an seo gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gcuirna meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthcháir in reachtam. Iadach sé tarann go raibh an orthcháir san i lis dúthail agus go mina fnacht gáir a chlig sár ducha sin éair. Ná ní bhíon ann tar d'oraach sé sin. Vin Marav.
Shachtan. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
On this week's Big Tech Show, when will cars safely drive themselves on our streets? And who in Ireland is providing the technology to help them do that? We talk to one of the country's biggest automotive autonomy entrepreneurs.
I have BMW Drive Assist in my own vehicle, and it is much, much safer because we are all prone to distraction, especially when we're on the motorway from Limerick to Dublin, for example. We've all been there where you actually forgot a whole section of the road. So I would say if you take it from a safety perspective, and it does allow you to kind of relax.
The Big Tech Show, available on all podcast platforms.
On the latest episode of Real Health with me, Carl Henry, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer, chatting all things the psychiatry of cancer.
I want to say that it's very common to be very distressed, to have a very prominent psychological response to cancer, that they are not alone, that lots of other people feel in that way, and that it's important for them to have information. Information is power, but it has to be the right information.
As ever, we're available on all podcast platforms.
The world is waking up to a new inflection point in the war in the Middle East.
So I think what he's doing is a mistake. I think it's outrageous. What I'm calling for is for a ceasefire.
Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas. That will not happen.
As the political situation in the Middle East continues to escalate, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continues to take a hard line, saying that he will not be influenced by anyone. As Washington considers imposing sanctions against some units of the Israeli Defense Forces for alleged human rights violations, Netanyahu has vowed to fight any such plans, despite the US passing a bill to send substantial military aid to Israel.
But there's also the help for Ukraine and Israel. $14 billion for Israel.
This has led world leaders to ask, what is Netanyahu's endgame? Many names have been given to Israel's longest-serving prime minister, from King Bibi to Mr. Security to the magician. But he has been an outspoken figure throughout his political career, from corruption charges to controversial comments on the Holocaust.
Hitler didn't want to exterminate the Jews at the time. He wanted to expel the Jews. And Khaja Amin al-Husseini went to Hitler and said, if you expel them, they'll all come here. So what should I do with them? He asked. He said, burn them.
I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by John Downing, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, to look at the life of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, to see if his past political decisions can determine what his next move will be in the tinderbox that is the Middle East. John Downing, Benjamin Netanyahu is a dominant force in world politics at the moment as the war in Gaza continues. He has been on the scene very much as a pivotal figure in Israel for nigh on three decades now. But let's go back to where he comes from, what influences him. Tell us about his background and his family beginnings.
He was born in Jaffa in Israel in 1949. His background is interesting. His mother was an Israeli Jew, but his father was originally from Poland. and said he could trace his origins back to the Jews in Spain who were expelled and dispersed at the time of the Spanish Inquisition and spread all over Europe. And they spoke a marvellous language called Ladin at the time. While his father was a secular Jew, not particularly religious, and later practiced with a very liberal sect of Jews, he was pretty strong on Zionism, the view of a Jewish homeland in the Middle East. And he was what's known as a revisionist Zionist, which meant politically he was a hardliner. He was against the idea of compromises with the neighbouring Arab states, for example. So this must have been a big political influence on the man who became known as Bibi.
So he grows up initially in Israel, and then the family moved to the United States.
Yes, the father was an academic and a teacher, and he went to teach at a big Jewish college there. So Benjamin Netanyahu's secondary education and that of his siblings, his brothers and sisters, was in Philadelphia, in high school. And this is where he honed his immaculate Americanized English, which has served him very well on the world stage.
Yeah, so he's basically in U.S. high school.
Yes.
In the 1960s, which is a very transformational time for America.
He wasn't exactly a flower power child. He didn't particularly want to go to San Francisco with flowers in his hair. In fact, while all his fellow school kids were vehemently against the Vietnam War and other things, he was rather pro, and he was something of a throwback or a counter-cultural, really, in his views.
So his own ideologies start to develop in his own head around this time, views on military action abroad, views about protection of a state and of a political way of life and so on.
Of course. And of course, while the Americans were putting flowers in their hair, the Israelis were defending themselves, and they would argue in a battle to exist. And this is a seminal period in his life because he leaves high school and goes and joins the Israeli army. And he serves through the teeth of the 1967 war.
He became a captain of an elite commando unit called Sayeret Matkal and participated in multiple combat missions before he was discharged in 1972. Upon which he returned to the U.S. to finish his education at MIT.
Another thing happened at that stage. His brother, Jonathan, was killed. There was an Israeli plane hijacked and taken to Entebbe. Netanyahu's older brother, Jonathan, led this counter-raid. Jonathan was killed in that Israeli operation. Again, a huge influence on Benjamin Netanyahu.
So Netanyahu, though, he returns to the U.S. and again continues with his education there.
Yes, again, quite brilliant, evidently, academically, described by one of the academics who taught him at the time in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, kind of as a young man in a hurry. He crammed a lot of courses together. He studied architecture and management, and he was studying for a doctorate in politics. But at a given point, he just chucked all of that. But he was certainly very successful and quite brilliant academically.
Now, Netanyahu, so, has been educated through the United States. His demeanor is as though he is American. Probably not that surprising, so, that he effectively goes into the diplomatic service for Israel.
Absolutely. The early 80s, 82, 84, he's Israel's ambassador at the UN, which is quite a very senior, heavy-hitting
post
for such a young man. Again, his immaculate, Americanized English stood him very much in good stead. He became a very well-known figure on American television, for example, all the time tirelessly advocating the Israeli case, their need to defend themselves to the nth degree, their need for continuous American support.
in terms of all America's allies, is that it is perhaps the only one who has taken care of itself so far. Israel is giving the United States an extraordinary bargain in the Middle East. It's the one stable democratic ally which the United States can count on.
Ultimately, he's now in the political realm, but he moves from diplomacy into elected politics.
Absolutely. In 92, 93, so on, he joins the right-wing Likud party, and he basically manages them and is quite successful with them. He briefly becomes prime minister in 1996, a terrible, terrible period. The Oslo Accords date from 1993, and they basically articulate the idea of a two-state solution for Palestine and Israel, that they could coexist more or less side by side, and that Jerusalem could be shared as a common capital. That, while it never really got off the ground, it was a period of great hope. Yitzhak Rabin was the inspirational leader of Israel through that period. It looked as though a major breakthrough was being achieved in the Middle East, but there was a huge backlash against Yitzhak Rabin.
Truly shocking news from the Middle East tonight. Israel's Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has been assassinated.
Evening spent dreaming of peace turns into a national nightmare.
Outside the hospital, a crowd began to chant, "Bibi is a murderer." Sign says, "Bibi, Rabin's blood is on your hands."
So in that period, Bill Clinton as the US president seemed to be determined to come up with some sort of resolution.
Yes.
Yasser Arafat, very prominent and well-known Palestinian leader as well, had vast experience and capital there as well. But ultimately, it doesn't really come to anything. And as you say, Netanyahu ends up becoming prime minister, and he's no real interest in continuing this path.
No, and it's interesting. His political approach to it is to neglect it and obstruct it rather than to directly attack it or very vehemently or vociferously oppose the Oslo Accords. But it's clear he has no intention of acting accordingly. And the one constant in his political, military and diplomatic career is a fervent belief that the only way the Israelis can have peace and security is to totally dominate the Palestinian community and to vanquish them.
So, brief period as prime minister, then ousted. It looks potentially like his political career is over when he fails to get re-elected. But then he comes back as a foreign minister underneath Ariel Sharon.
Quite the political survivor. But it has to be said also, Finan, that he's had more than a whiff of scandal surrounding him and his family over the years. Allegations that he has accepted bribes, gifts, and allegations that he kept gifts which are above a certain value are more usually the property of the state and the taxpayer rather than the individual who receives them on behalf of the country. So this has dogged him. And indeed, right to the current day, there are three separate cases involving allegations of corruption going against him. In a most extraordinary vista, he continues to serve as prime minister, but he also continues to defend cases of alleged corruption against himself. So it's quite an extraordinary thing, and mirrors, of course, Trump.
From being foreign minister, serving throughout the 2000s, he's back in then as prime minister from 2009 to 2021. Long period of 12 years. And ultimately, he's ousted after 12 years in 2021. And again, it seems he's gone. He's finished.
Yes. And again, he manages to survive. He's made his name and his primary political strength in Israel is that he's labelled as Mr. Security. On his watch, Israel have made huge investments in technology, in so-called peace walls and fences, keeping the Palestinian population enclosed, and also developing settlements on the West Bank, as opposed to Gaza, where the current conflict is. And the political company he keeps
Netanyahu is forming a coalition with right-wing leaders who, until now, have been on the fringes of Israeli politics. Like Itamar Ben-Gvir, convicted of supporting a terrorist organization and inciting racism. And Bezalel Smotrich, whose religious Zionist party has called for expanding illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank and even the annexation of land there.
While he can be very affable and polished when speaking English, his critics continuously accuse him of using dog whistle type approach and saying ambivalent things about Palestinians, but also about Arab citizens of Israel.
So he returns as Prime Minister in 2022, and then the 7th of October attacks by Hamas on Israeli soil. How much damage does that do to him as this great Mr. Security of Israel?
It did him huge damage, because the legend was that such an attack would never be possible. It rocked Israeli confidence to the core. They did not believe such a thing was possible. It did huge and lasting damage to Netanyahu. In a funny way, there was a kind of a fillip for him in the immediate aftermath, because, for example, he was under increasing pressure. He was accused of interfering with judicial independence in changing the court system. And there were national protests about that. And there were also talk of all kinds of boycotts and other things, which were all put on hold as the nation felt they would just have to pull together to face the Hamas threat.
We have obviously seen over the course of the last 6 months that the response to the October 7th attacks have been pretty brutal and condemned by our own government, indeed, as being disproportionate. How is he thought of now on the world stage, and how, at the same time, has he managed to retain support in the United States?
The United States is central to his, and indeed to Israel's, position in the world. President Joe Biden talks about this ironclad determination to continue supporting Israel. But on the world stage, Benjamin Netanyahu is seen to be something of a pariah. 33,000 people have been killed. There's malnutrition. There's child suffering. There are all sorts of horrific excesses. Aid is only trickling in to Gaza, and Gaza was heavily aid dependent. Sometimes up to 500 trucks a day used to go into Gaza carrying aid. So it's a totally unacceptable and appalling situation globally. But as long while the Americans are trying around the margins to coax him into a more amenable approach to the whole issue, but in the meantime, they are not putting it right up to Israel or Netanyahu.
So where is Netanyahu at now? I mean, is there an exit strategy here? I mean, is it just the case that he needs the conflict to continue to distract from his other woes? This is what allows him to cling to power. Israel is at war. Israel is under attack. He's the man to respond to that. Once that ends, is it effectively the end of his career, and he has to deal with all his other troubles down the courts?
Well, there is that view, and many of his critics would strongly make all of the points which you have just made, that he does need this, otherwise he could be in jail. The three cases he could conceivably face anything up to 10 years in prison, according to the gravity of these offences. But in the meantime, it's very hard to see an end to this. His stated ambition is to absolutely hammer Hamas and obliterate it. But Hamas is an idea as much as anything else, and I don't know how you can kill an idea. Hamas surely would reemerge in some other shape or form, even if he was able to smash it, which is questionable as well.
As you look back over the history of Israel, he's certainly the dominant figure of recent times. Would you regard him as the significant figure in the history of the Israeli state?
He's certainly up there. As things stand, I think he is certainly the best known Israeli citizen on the planet right now. He has been a huge influence in the whole Middle East conflict and arguably has deeply obstructed any hope of resolution between Palestinians and the Israelis. He has totally smashed the hope of the Oslo Accords and the two-state solution, won't engage in any way along those lines. So he has been a very negative influence in the Middle East and, by extension, the world generally.
And my thanks to John Downing for joining me today. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Garrett Mulhall, researched by Dave Hannerty, with sound by Gavin Hennessy. Archive clips from Sky News, The Guardian, NBC News, CBC News, Frontline PBS, and MSNBC. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to follow and leave us a review.
This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave. 1919, 1920, there's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.